From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. Of course, along with your calls, some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Right, tea bags. You may be getting more than you think, and that more might turn out to be plastic. And red meat. Should we now start to eat it? Is it steak tonight, honey, or not?
Any red meat in our recipe?
No, it's Mediterranean chicken. It's a delicious recipe that I am sure you will love. Even you will love this recipe, Tom. I mean, come on, it's chicken.
Yeah, it sounds good. It sounds good it's to
chicken.
Me. Let's get to the phones now, Zorba, at 1-800-462-7413, 800-462-7413. Our first caller joins us now, a listener in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, my sister was on the internet and heard about leaky gut syndrome and getting rid of her lectins and everything, and she jumped on that bandwagon so fast because it's going to cure everything she has, including my autoimmune diseases, all of her body inflammation, and she's really pushing it hard on me and my father, who's 96, which, believe me, whatever he's doing, I think he's doing fine. But what I want to know, she's buying, it's a doctor that was a heart. I can't say who he is, I don't suppose.
Daddy.
He was a famous heart surgeon at one time, and now he's an expert on all of this. He's got all sorts
famous.
Of books and products to sell.
Right. Now, let me get straight. He's famous. I mean, we know who made him famous, probably Facebook. And now he's selling books and products and making money on books and products. Okay, so please.
Exactly.
Go.
And the diet's very, very limited. You can't have any lectins. You've got to do all this other stuff. And she says it's been a miracle for her. It's just cured everything.
Of course. You know, the nice thing about, first of all, the nice thing about the internet is you can say anything you want to. You make a really good internet page. You can do it. You can have all these people saying, he is the expert. He's so tall. He's like an 8 foot tall. He's the biggest doctor in the world. He's like 8 foot tall walking around. And all the other doctors in the world kowtow to him. They just bow as the doctor passes and go, you are so good. You really know everything. And you know everything. And nobody else knows anything. And by the way, you know everything so much that you can just charge lots of money for lectins and loctins and loctins and all the other stuff that goes on the internet.
You're just sorry that you're not 8 foot tall.
I'm sorry that that's not the case. So anyway, so what's your sister spending on this, by the way? Do you have any idea?
I don't have a clue, but what I really want to know is leaky gut really a syndrome?
No, it is not a syndrome. So first of all, if your gut leaks into your abdomen, it's a medical emergency, and at that point, you need surgery or you die. So first of all, let's talk about that. You know, a leaking gut is a medical emergency. That's what appendicitis is. It's a leaking gut. So leaky gut syndrome is this idea. Let's give it something like we're leaking out our nutrients, and what we have to do is follow a special diet. And if we follow the special diet, Mother Nature will come into us and actually cure us, and it'll cure everything that ails us. And it turns out to be incorrect. And we can use other words for incorrect, but this is public radio, and so those words cannot be said in public, but only in private. And so, you know, that's sort of the latest thing. And this idea about lectins, you know, that all of a sudden these chemicals within our body will actually make changes in our body, just turn out not to follow any scientific, you know, any science at all. Now, the other thing about when this goes on and when doctors and other people actually do it, they'll say, there are studies on this. Well, you can do a study on anything and call it a study. There are studies and there are studies, right? There are good studies and there are studies that are absolutely junk studies. And any studies that have been done on this are basically junk studies. Now, what about your relative? What should you tell her? Well, it's good for her, and it works for her, but I want to talk about your dad. So your dad is 96, did you say?
Yes.
He will be next month,
he will
yeah.
be 96. How's he doing?
He's amazing, but he's eaten vegetables and fruit all of his life. He's very active. He's a poster child for good health.
So he's a poster child for good health, and he's 96. Mm. And so we want to go in and say, hey, wait a minute, you're a poster child for good health. You're 96. You have proven longevity, but we want to now alter what you're eating in your diet because we think it'll work even better when, in fact, you're actually a 10 right now. To me, that is absolutely a silly thing to do. So keep your sister away from your dad. that's kind of what I would recommend.
Keep your sister. And me too. Me too.
Yeah, and from you too. Yeah, yeah. How is your health, by the way?
Well, you know, I've got a few things. I've got psoriatic arthritis and the chronic bowel syndrome and things like that. But otherwise, I'm doing quite good.
Yeah.
Quite good.
Yeah. My belief is the Mediterranean diet is a proven diet that works. Putting in fruits and vegetables, you know, limiting the amount of red meat when you have protein, it should be fish protein twice a week. Glass of red wine with your meal will be perfect. And, of course, sit outside in the sun whenever you can and enjoy it. That's the diet.
Well, my dad's a big proponent for the Mediterranean diet. I'm a little bit overweight. And when we go to lunch, he says the Mediterranean diet is the best. Unfortunately, I can't drink alcohol. But I'm really working at that.
You're doing it. Your dad is doing it. Follow your father. Don't follow your sister.
Well, thank you, thank you, thank you. We're going to listen to this as a family together.
Well, thanks so much for your call.
Yeah, and call us back again when you're 96.
I will. I will, I will, I will. You folks have a great day.
Yeah, you too. 800-462-7413.
You know, if we're still here when she's 96, this is how it's on. This is Wisconsin.
Zorba Pastor. 800-462-7413, our number. We talk about tea bags now, Zorba.
Well, that's interesting. So we think of tea as the healthy drink, right?
You know, sure.
I mean, we think of tea as the healthy
drink. My wife drinks it, and she does nothing that isn't healthy.
That's right. It's the healthy drink. And we think of coffee as sort of coffee, you know what I mean? It's kind of like having alcohol. Yep. Coffee is not quite the same as tea. But this is a very interesting study that came out of the American Chemical Society. It's the Journal of Environmental Science and Technology. And plastic tea bags, okay, so tea bags, plastic tea bags, you know, that you kind of put in there. They actually are made of plastics. Can release, now get this, 11.6 billion microplastic and 3.1 billion nanoplastic particles into a single cup of tea.
That sounds like a lot.
Sounds like a lot. You know what? Nothing gets past you. you know that a billion is a big number, Tom. You know what? You know what? A. You got an A for effort and an A for arithmetic.
Well, I didn't get any A's in math, I can tell you.
A's in math, but you know that a billion is a big number. Yeah. And this is kind of interesting because what's interesting is I didn't even think of microplastics in tea. You know, I think of the fact that tea is manufactured and it's put in this little tea bag. And when I want to have my tea bag out, I always feel righteous when I have tea. Like I have the hot water there and I put the tea bag in and I feel like I'm giving myself a healthful drink. And when I have coffee, I always feel a little bit like, you know, the devil is in me and I'm having something shouldn't be having.
Right.
It's kind of a funny thing. But the fact is these chemicals are obviously manufactured in a whole bunch of things that we're not even aware of. And we do not know the environmental impact of these chemicals. Like, do they have a meaning or they don't have a meaning? And WHO has said these potential hazards from microplastics in everything, in beauty products and now in tea bags, are something that we have to look at because they're in the manufacturing process.
Well, a tea bag doesn't melt in the tea, so you put the tea bag
and take it out, and the microplastic stuff will come out. No, it goes in the water. What is the tea bag made of? You know, we think of a tea bag as made of something, but it's not made of a totally biodegradable substance. So the tea bag itself must have plastic in it, and so which I never really realized. And it may not be all tea bags. It may be some tea bags. And I know that we must have tea lovers in our audience who will write us and let us know about teas that have microplastics and teas that don't have microplastics. Mm-hmm. I've not done any research on it. I looked at the study, found it very interesting because I think of tea as being sort of pure, you know, kind of a Puritan type product. So one of the issues are we've got to get a handle on microplastics, whether or not they affect health, whether or not they're adverse to us at all. We don't have enough research on it. And I'm afraid that your wife, Monica, who righteously drinks tea and thinks that she is drinking a healthful product, might have to look at some of the tea that she's drinking and realize it may not be as healthful as she thinks.
I hope she isn't listening, and I'm not going to tell her.
So if she's not listening, she won't know about it. Yeah. And when we do the research, then we'll find out and let her know.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in El Paso, Texas. Hi.
Hello. How are you doing, Dr. Zorba?
Excellent. Thank you. Excellent. How can we help you?
Well, I have a question about just gender therapy on this, or gender identity question. If a male's converting to a female, or they want to, I heard this. I guess it's a hormone, spironolactone. Mm-hmm. Are the effects reversible on that? And also, I have another question. What is the professional association, like the American Pediatric Association, say about gender identity? It's confusing to me. I always thought there were just two genders. I don't know. I'll just listen.
Well, first of all, it is confusing. It's confusing, I think, to a lot of people in the medical community as it goes forward, and people who are born and they feel that they're in the wrong gender, and so their gender identity questions. But first of all, let me answer the spironolactone. So spironolactone is a diuretic, and it's a diuretic actually that we find very useful in the treatment of hypertension and heart failure. But one of the side effects of that as a diuretic is it's very useful to reduce hair. So in other words, it can reduce hair in the body, and it's very useful for reducing hair on the face. So a number of women, traditionally women who have hair on their face, and there's some women who produce more testosterone than others, naturally born women who have XX chromosomes, will take spironolactone because they may have facial hair that they don't want to grow. So for a male that is then becoming a female, taking spironolactone can help reduce the amount of hair that's actually produced. And that's, as my understanding of where spironolactone is used. It may also be used when a man then becomes a woman. You're also using estrogen and estrogen products, and sometimes you're using anti-testosterone products, but usually using estrogen products. And doing that also means you want to have a reduction in facial hair. So I hope I've answered that part. And that's to the best of my ability. You know, as far as you said, are there two genders? Are there not two genders? Well, there are two genders in an XX chromosome and an XY chromosome. So from that point of view, physiologically, but from a point of view of what goes on inside the brain and how people feel, that is a completely different issue. And I think as physicians, we are now beginning to discover that there have been many more things that occur within the body that we have yet to understand. And if you look 20 years ago, you know, gender dysphoria and gender changes were something that were just beginning to come on the horizon. And so I think this has to be played out. And I'm definitely not an expert in this, but what I do is I recognize that there are different genders, and the most important thing here is to respect people and respect their choices and respect that it's not really a choice, but it's something that they're born with. And I think that as we develop over time, we'll develop more understanding with this. Why are you interested in this? Is this somebody who you know of? What is going on?
Yeah,
what's the reason behind it?
Well, doctor, a friend of my son's, you know, I just think that they may maybe have influence. You know, I mean, obviously, it's almost easier to say if they were, you know, in what they acted like, if they were, you know, if they could define, but they can't, you know, and I understand the confusion. So it would seem like you would want to try to get your body to match your feelings rather than do, you know, I guess the end product is a real I'm trying to think of an operation. Mm-hmm. I don't think necessarily that they all go through this, mm-hmm. but a transition. You know, maybe they need to psychologically try to help their psyche. In other words, to try to match what they have as far as the, you know, their gender. I mean, their equipment, so to speak. I can't really think of a better word.
I think you actually said it. You said it very well. That's been an issue that is ongoing. You know, the idea, for instance, that gay men and gay women would then go and get psychological counseling and discover they weren't gay. And we know, of course, that does not work. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very interesting. Many, many years ago, I had a patient of mine, and his wife called me up because she said their son came out and was gay. This is maybe 20 years ago. And could I meet with him because he was really upset? And I met with him in my office, and he said, you know, I think my son, he and his son were having trouble getting along. I think my son became gay just to spite me. And I looked at him and I said, you're nuts. What gay man chooses to be gay? We're talking about 25 years ago. What gay man chooses to be gay? The answer is it's not a choice that is involved. But now we have other changes that have occurred over the last 25 years. It gets to be played out over time. There's no doubt that psychological counseling has to play a role because within society, these are not easy issues. And it's not as if all of a sudden we're welcoming to all of the changes that are going on. So I think, as you said, with your son's friend, the best thing you can do for your son is support the fact that he should support his friend as his friend goes through whatever situation is going through, either with transition or non-transition, but to make sure that he has a support system that sees him as a person and sees him as a good person and helps him through whatever goes on in terms of the issues that happen with his family and with his friends. That's always my advice. Look at the person, help the person, support the person.
All right. That sounds good. Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome. Hope that helped.
Yeah. Appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Before the break now, Zorba, time for the segment where you clarify something a listener has read on the internet.
Really? Somebody has read on the internet? Shocking.
This is called Google Doc.
Qualify as electronic music. That's all I want to know.
Okay, Zorba. This one came from Lisa in Madison, Wisconsin. She writes, "Hi, Dr. Zorba. A local person promoting blood donations says, donate blood and you'll lose a pound. I used to donate in college for altruistic reasons and have started again. However, afterwards, for a week, I've had symptoms of lightheadedness and I feel tired. Mm-hmm. I went online and found statements that said donating blood can do the following. Your blood may flow longer, your iron levels will stay balanced, and you could live longer." Well, I was going to ask what you think,
That's my answer, right. You know, when you donate your blood, your iron count goes down because you just gave blood. Do you lose a pound? Well, you lose whatever the blood weighs that takes out. So if they take out 8 ounces of blood, you lose 8 ounces of weight at that time. But you will gain the weight back right away. I mean, it's not as if...
It isn't a diet thing.
I know, it's not a diet thing. Donate blood for your diet. You know, hey, I want to lose 20 pounds before my wedding. I'll just keep on donating blood. I don't think it's really very good. But donating blood, you actually help other people. And, you know, for altruistic reasons, donating blood is a good thing.
Okay, Zorba, I'm glad we did this email because I have a classic blood donation joke for you.
Oh, God.
Ready?
Yes, I'm ready. Okay.
What is the best song to listen to while giving blood?
I have no idea.
You're so vain. You think this song is about you. From Carly Simon. Have a healthy living question for Zorba. Feel free to post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org. And Tom, I think as a singer, I got to tell you something. You know, I mean, Monica,
it better be positive.
I'm sure Monica loves to hear you sing.
Anyway, our delicious chicken recipe is coming up, along with more of your calls, of course, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Before our next call, Zorba, Mediterranean chicken.
That's right. Do you like chicken?
Yeah.
I like chicken. I like different chicken dishes.
And I like Mediterranean, okay,
yeah,
too.
You like Mediterranean. Yeah, yeah. We ought to go on the Mediterranean Sea. What we need is a WPR cruise on the Mediterranean Sea.
There you go.
You would come. Monica would come. Maybe we'd do the whole thing. Let's do that.
Okay.
Do that sometime.
Okay.
I figured I'd do that. Okay. So start out with 2 tablespoonfuls of all-purpose flour.
2 big tea all-purpose flour.
Pinch of cayenne pepper.
Pinch of cayenne.
2 tablespoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil.
2 big tea, extra virgin olive oil.
So 3 large chicken breasts. So these are boneless, skinless chicken breasts, pounded or thinly sliced. So let me explain a little bit about this.
Sure.
So you get a chicken breast, okay, boneless, skinless chicken breast, and you take a hammer. Now, I don't mean a regular hammer. It's got to be a hammer that is used for this. Regular hammer, the thing is going to splurt around. But these are hammers with little kind of, how do I explain it, little feet in them. They're not really feet, mm-hmm. but little kind of feet, that's the best way. And you bang this chicken breast and you make it thinner and thinner and thinner. Mm. And it makes the whole thing different. You've got to have one of these hammers. They don't cost very much. They aren't at the hardware store unless they have a lot of kitchen stuff. Mm-hmm. But they're called, I don't know what they're called. They're probably called breast hammers or something like that. But
breast
you
hammers? I wouldn't
think
of chicken.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Went too far. But anyway, yeah. You need to pound it down with whatever you call these things. And if anyone knows what you call these things, send me an email. Okay. So 3 large chicken breasts pounded down.
3 large chicken breasts, like you said. Okay.
Pounded them.
Yeah.
Juice of half a lemon.
A juice of half a lemon.
And then you're going to use some extra lemon slices mm-hmm. in the other part. 2 large garlic cloves sliced.
2 large cloves sliced.
That's right. 1/3 cup of sliced Kalamata olives. I am sure I am mispronouncing that. Thank you very much, grammar police. Kalamata olives.
That's 1/3 cup sliced Kalamata olives.
See, and you mispronounce it too. I pronounce it Kalamata, but it's probably Kalamata, and you pronounce it Kalamata. But anyway,
what I mean. Okay.
1/3 cup of green olives.
A third of a cup of green olives,
mm-hmm. marinated if you've got them. 3 tablespoonfuls of parsley, Italian parsley, if you have it.
3 big tea, fresh Italian parsley.
8 ounces of crumbled feta.
8 ounces of crumbled feta.
1/2 teaspoon of kosher salt.
1/2 tea kosher salt.
2 teaspoons of butter.
2 little tea butter.
And there's going to be some fresh pepper in there, too.
Okay, fresh pepper.
Are you ready to make it, Tom?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Theoretically, just picture yourself in your kitchen. You've got your apron on. Monica's sort of standing there. She just poured you a cup of wine. You're the chef. You got the image. You're the chef.
I cannot picture that in any way, shape, or form.
You're standing there. There are people sitting at the table drinking some wine, watching you do the magic of this recipe.
Okay.
That's what we do. We call this Tom's Fairy Tale.
They don't want to eat after they see what I'm
Tom doing. Makes dinner. So combine the flour and cayenne in a shallow bowl. Okay, you're going to do that in a shallow bowl. Now, heat the olive oil in a skillet on medium heat until it's sort of warm to hot. Dredge the chicken in the flour, shaking off the excess flour. Place it in the hot skillet. Cook it until golden brown. Flip it. It's about 3 minutes on each side. Hmm. Turn it over. When you turn it over, you're going to add lemon juice, lemon slices, garlic, 1.5 tablespoonfuls of the parsley, salt, and pepper. Cook it for another 8 to 10 minutes. Shake the pan a little bit if you want to. This stuff is on the top of it, and you want to stir that olive mixture gently to avoid burning the garlic because that's in the pan. Mm-hmm. Add the butter to the pan. Shake it to combine that sauce. Now, take the chicken breasts on a serving plate, then pour the olive oil mixture over the top, which is now buttery. Garnish with the remaining 1.5 tablespoonfuls of olive. Mm-hmm. You now have it on the plate. You take the plate. I got to spell this out for you, Tom. You then take the plate and you put it on the table where the people are sitting. Mm-hmm. You then pour the wine in the glasses of the people. Mm. You then lift the glass of wine as you put it on ceremony, and you say, bon appetit. Can you hear that? Say, aha. Actually, you could say bon appetit, aha. You could just say aha,
now,
actually.
Question.
Yeah.
We have 3 chicken breasts.
That's right.
What if there are 2 of us?
You have 1 chicken breast for the next day. You could also say, what if there are 4 people? One person goes hungry, and it's hot potato, and they don't get to eat. And that's part of – it's a new way of serving food. One person doesn't get to eat the meal. You know what? They get Rice Krispies. If you want a copy of today's recipe, write us. Actually, you don't write us, but go to Zorba@WPR.org. You can write us, and you can go to ZorbaPastor.org to see this recipe. Or, of course, you can come through Facebook. And let's hope that at the next dinner table, when I have 4 people or 2 people over for dinner, I'm going to only make 3 portions and see what happens and see what Penny has to say.
800-462-7413 is our number. Back to the phones now, Zorba, listener with us in Franklin, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about plastic. We all got the message that using plastic containers in microwaves was not a good idea. And I actually replaced my plastic containers with glass, and I even used the glass for storage. Mm-hmm. But then I go to the store, and there's all these plastic bags with frozen vegetables, mostly frozen vegetables in them, and that's for the microwave. Mm-hmm. I don't quite understand. I feel a little guilty when I use one of those, and I'm wondering, Dr. Zorba, I'd like your opinion on that.
Well, it's a great question. I mean, you bring up a lot of points. So first of all, there's some plastic you don't reheat it with because we know that there's a good chance the plastic may melt and actually get into the food. And that's sort of the theory behind there is microwave-safe and non-microwave-safe things for your food. Uh-huh. Now, what about the plastic? I know what you're talking about because I know just what it is. It'll be broccoli, and it'll say heat in bag, and you can put it in the bag. So somebody has looked at that bag and said, this plastic is safe to heat in the microwave, and it's okay. Well, what does that mean? Who made it safe?
Yeah, there's a lot of chemicals in plastic.
Right. I mean, who made, because you make plastic. Who decided this is safe? Well, we know it's not going to melt because if it melts, they're not going to sell the broccoli. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if you put broccoli in there and you do it and all of a sudden melts, you're not going to buy it. So it doesn't do that. It undoubtedly has air holes in it of some sort because the steam is there. I mean, I've done it and it's sort of I can smell the broccoli as it's there. But I don't think it's safe. I mean, I don't think it's safe. So I take it out and I put it in my glass container and put it in there. But I also don't know who called it safe. So maybe the FDA called it safe, but where did the FDA make its decision on calling it safe? Especially since we now know that tea bags, and we now know tea bags, may have microplastic spheres in them when you're actually doing a cup of tea with some tea bags. So I think this is a big, big issue. I don't heat in plastic. That's
all right. I felt guilty whenever I would do that, and now I I am not going to use it. I will do what you do.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think that it's very good for me to assuage your guilt. My last name is Pastor, so I have the ability to assuage guilt. It's not exactly an indulgence.
Well.
It's not an indulgence, but I hope that it's public radio assuaging of guilt.
Well, I really appreciate your telling me what you know about this, because I can't find any information on it at all.
No, and I don't know where the information is. I don't trust it. Use glass.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I really do appreciate
that. Take care now.
And thank you so much for that call at 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now from Fairbanks, Alaska. Hi.
Hi. I have three female friends, one in her mid-60s, one mid-70s, one mid-80s. And all three this year have told me that they have lost their peristaltic action.
Mm-hmm.
The youngest one told me that it was recommended to her that she stand up eating and that she eat hot soup. The oldest one had a lot of problems and ended up in the hospital for 2 days because she lost all of her nutrients in her system. And she received no recommendation from her provider.
Mm-hmm.
She was told to just go home and do the same thing she was doing, which I didn't understand at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the youngest person told me that her provider told her the reason that this happens is because you get older. and it happens to people over like 50 or something.
Mm-hmm. So 50 is old? That's all I want to know.
Well, I'm past that also, but, apparently the musculature that squeezes the food down into your stomach ceases to function properly.
Well, as you get older, just like other muscles in your body, your gut slows down. I mean, older people all the time complain about constipation. I could write books on constipation. I could do one half on constipation and the other half on gas. It's either constipation or gas. Younger people never talk about constipation, except, I got constipated because I went on a trip. And as for talking about gas, that's like a tween and teenage talk. And after that, they don't really talk about it. And that's because peristalsis changes. Diabetes, among other things, can change it. There's something called diabetic gastroparesis, great big long-term, which means your gut doesn't function properly. And it's really secondary to diabetes, and you can have stomach problems really from that. And as you get older, your gut can slow down, and so if you eat too quickly when you're older, it can cause problems. Now, I've never given anyone advice that they should eat standing up. Because what difference does it make if you're standing up or if you're sitting? Because if you're sitting straight up, the food is going to go down. Now, you don't want to eat lying in a recumbent position because your food is not going to go down. So it makes sense you should sit up. It also makes sense that you should have liquid with your food because that actually helps. It really helps with friction in the gut. It also helps to eat slower. It makes a difference. And hot water does make a difference. Old Dr. Kellogg, he was old when I first joined him, although right now I'm older than he was when I first joined him, but I was a young whippersnapper. And he would always tell people with constipation and problems with swallowing, which happens when they're older, take some hot water before you eat and have hot water throughout the meal. And that was an old-fashioned remedy that really works really well because hot water actually stimulates the gut, and importantly, it actually stimulates peristalsis in the colon, which helps with constipation and having a bowel movement. So I don't think standing up is going to do much, but hot water is really a good idea, even though standing up is not going to do much. So nutrients in the body getting lost, I'm not sure exactly what that is. I know that if we look at vitamin B12, because as we get older, we lose something called intrinsic factor, which is in the small intestine, and you may get a B12 deficiency. That's a very specific thing. Some people can handle that if it's minimal with a B12 supplement. Other people actually need to get an injection once a month. And as for the person whose doctor gave them no advice and sent them home, I'd probably switch doctors with that person. And be my answer for that.
Neither one of us were impressed, but thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate your time.
You're welcome. How's your gut, by the way?
It's just fine, thank you. I make sure things move right along.
That's right. That's right. You know, happy gut, happy life. That's what we say.
Yes, indeed.
Thanks for your call. Thanks
appreciate
for sharing
the call
that.
800-462-7413. Before the break now, Zorba, let's check in again with your favorite do-gooders, the always pesky Grammar Police.
Oh no, it's the Grammar Police.
Actually, Zorba, this one comes from...
The Punctuation Police?
Drum roll... Recipe Police.
Okay. I didn't even know they were out there. They must be a subgroup. You know what? They're like Men in Black. Yeah. Recipe Men and Women in Black.
That was kind of a weak drum roll.
Yeah, well, what can I do? You know, I'm not a drummer.
Beth in Jacksonville, Florida, sent us the following email. Dr. Zorba, thank you for sharing your recipe for potato salad and avocados. The recipe sounds delicious, and I can't wait to try it. However,
there's always, every police has a however in there or a but.
I'd like to correct a grammatical error you made.
Oh, okay.
When you said that the avocados were divided, you stated that meant they are cut in chunks. What divided actually means in a recipe is that the ingredient is used in two ways. For example, in your recipe, part of it was used for the dressing and part in the salad itself.
So wait a minute. A time out for a second.
Sure.
So in other words, I'm not supposed to say divided into chunks. I'm supposed to say cut into chunks. Or split into chunks. Is that the verb I'm supposed to use? I just want to know.
I think either one of those.
I can't use the word
right?
divided.
You can't okay? use divided.
Yeah, I can't use divided.
That's for
I
sure.
I can't use divided. Okay, all right. Okay.
Do you want
Smashed
to join?
Smashed into chunks. Split into chunks.
Split. Works.
I'll use the word split. Next time I...
Not
split.
Divided.
Smashed into chunks.
Do you want to join the ever-growing Grammar Police? Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at...
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your calls coming up, another topic to talk about, all coming up right here on Zorba Pastor and Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. The number to call if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, studies on the impact of eating more red meat.
Right. Interesting study. Talk about controversy. This is controversy.
Okay.
Published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, the study concluded, and the study is quite an interesting study, that there's really very little evidence that eating red meat affects heart disease, cancer, or diabetes.
Yay!
Right, Tom. You can have steak tonight, steak tomorrow, steak the next day, beef stew the next day, and then you can have, you know, a hunk of rib roast the day after that.
What's the science on this here?
Well, that's kind of interesting. So first of all, there's some interesting science. We'll talk about that. It's published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, not a junk journal, a really good journal. But then the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine said this is a misrepresentation. It's bad. The American Heart Association called the conclusions questionable. I agree with them. They certainly are questionable because they said that. Then there are a number of other associations that said you should retract this because this is really bad and you're going to – all of a sudden people are going to start eating lots of red meat. And the reality is, The red meat connection with heart disease, cancer, has always been a messy connection because the information that we have, especially from eating years ago, has to do with the whole way that we were eating. We were meat and potatoes and red meat and eating bad stuff. We were not eating fruits and vegetables. And when you're looking over a long term, that's part of it. But the Heart Association still recommended that we should decrease the amount of red meat that we eat. And they're still on there. But let's not forget, they've recommended the carnivore diet for years. You know, eat nothing that tastes good and you will live a long life. I mean, you look at the AHA diet and it's an awful diet. And the Mediterranean diet, of course, looks at good fats such as in fish. And if you're going to use red meat, you really use it in small amounts. So it's sort of for flavoring versus eating that chunk of meat. But this, going back to the study, there was some interesting science behind it. And they said, wait a minute, the connection between red meat is not as solid as we thought before. And maybe this is a time to think about it again. I like that idea. You know, just like eggs, maybe we should rethink about eggs again. You know, we've been limiting eggs. Eggs contain lycopene, among other things, and we've had an increase in macular degeneration, maybe because of that.
You still like vegetables, though.
Well, of course I like vegetables. And I do eat red meat. I don't eat red meat every day, obviously. But I think this particular study is just saying, wait a minute, maybe the connection is not as absolute as we think, but I'm really with the Heart Association idea that we still should limit red meat. The question is, what's limiting red meat? What does it mean? Is it 4 servings a week? Is it 3? Is it 2? Is it 1? That remains to be seen, and this question needs to still be answered.
1-800-462-7413 is our number. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in Webster, Wisconsin. Hi.
Thank you very much for taking my phone call. I find it an honor and a pleasure to be able to talk to Dr. Zorba and to you, Tom.
Yeah,
thank you.
Our honor. How can we help?
Well, my bottom line question is, I'm a 71-year-old male, in pretty good shape, 5 feet 10, 158 pounds, very active. My dad died of a heart attack at a young age. I've always had pretty good physical examinations, but my last physical, my blood pressure has always been iffy. That's been being controlled by lisinopril, and it's in the area of 135 over 76, right in that area. But and I've always had excellent cholesterol, but the last physical, my cholesterol had shot up to a total of, it's now 220. The HDL is 79, and the LDL is 128.
It's great. You've got a really, I mean, HDL of 79 is super high, so it may have gone up because your HDL, which is your good cholesterol, went up, and your LDL is on target.
Well, based on that panel, the doctor recommended that I have a CT scan where they address the calcium.
I don't believe much in CT scans, but let me talk about it for a second. So your dad was how old when he died?
62.
And did he smoke cigarettes?
He was a heavy smoker.
So he was a heavy smoker, meaning he smoked more than a pack. World War II guy, heavy smoker, died at 62, common. That was common. And cigarettes were the toxin. So you've got a super high HDL of 79. You exercise. I mean, you know, your LDL is at, you know, is at goal. So your LDL is there. Your dad died at 62, but he was a smoker. So let's look at something. The calcium score is the idea of whether or not we can really predict whether or not you're going to have a heart attack. And it's iffy in many situations. I mean, I'm not a big proponent. The last time I ordered it was never. I've never ordered that particular test, so that I can tell you what a proponent is. So let's assume your calcium score is up that shows you've got some calcified plaques. Those are not the plaques that actually cause you to have a heart attack. Would you go on a statin drug with these great numbers?
Well, that's my question, Dr. Zorba. I'm not a pill guy, and I'll take the lisinopril, but he's recommending 20 milligrams of a statin.
I don't think you need a statin at all. I totally disagree. The reason why your cholesterol is elevated is because of your good cholesterol. Your good cholesterol, you said, was 79, and your bad cholesterol, what was the LDL again?
It was 128.
You know, 130 is fine. You don't need a statin. And you don't need a test. I want to talk a bit about overtesting. There's something called VOMIT, Victims of Medical Information Technology. So we do a test, and then we make a decision, and the decision is whack-a-mo. And whack-a-mo is, oh, you've got a high calcium score. And all of a sudden, you get anxious. Oh, I'm anxious. I've got a high calcium score. My dad died at 62. He died because he smoked cigarettes, and he was a World War II vet. But now I'm worried about my calcium score. What should I do? So I'm going to take a statin. But I don't really need a statin based on American Heart Association criteria and other criteria because I've got a super high HDL of 79. So you have to decide what you want to do. To me, don't do the test. I don't think it's necessary. And if you have a doctor who insists on doing the test, switch doctors.
Well, I certainly appreciate your advice. Like I said, I've been struggling with this for about a month now, and I said, I'll go to the source that knows. So here I am.
Thanks. Thanks for the compliment.
Don't worry. You're going to live to be 80.
Higher than 80. Higher than 80. 92.
800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, time to unholster your gavel and powder up your parliamentary wig. This is the segment we call Judge Zorba.
That's my gavel.
Yeah, I heard. The following email came to us from Melinda in Springfield, Missouri. She writes, Hi, Zorba. First, I love your show and have listened for many years. I'm over 60 years old.
By the way, Tom, always compliment the judge. Very important.
Oh. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor. And she complimented the judge. Okay.
I'm over 60 years old and have always been a bath taker. Mm-hmm. In recent times, I feel bath shamed by some that prefer to take showers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
These bath shamers make me feel less clean and say baths are gross. Is there any evidence bathers are less clean after a bath than shower takers?
I will come down on this lickety-split. Here we go. No, there is no evidence that bathers are dirtier than showerers. It's really a function of what you actually want to do and however you feel
comfortable.
What do you
mean, what you want to do?
Do you want to go into a bath or do you want to go into a shower? So the answer is no. Bathe away and tell those anti-bathers that they are wrong, and Judge Zorba said so.
Have a suit you need settled, perhaps a bathing suit? Judge Zorba's always happy to lay down the law, or at least just lay down in the bath. Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Back to the phones now, Zorba at 800-462-7413. We welcome a caller now in Orchard Park, New York. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Anyhow, this is my tale of woe. I had shingles 20 years ago before I knew about shingles and the shingles vaccine. As a result, I was left with postherpetic neuralgia, which I know that you know is a constant pain on, in my case, the right side of my face, including the jaw and the gums. To manage the pain, I've been taking gabapentin or Neurontin, 600 milligrams three times a day. Mm-hmm. My primary doctor told me that gabapentin might become a controlled substance, and he might not be able to prescribe it.
By the way, I just want to stop you right there.
Mm-hmm.
It's never going to become a controlled substance. Lyrica, pregabalin, which is a relative of gabapentin, is a controlled substance in that it seems to make people feel better and happier. And the feds wondered when they approved that whether or not it was actually going to be a drug of abuse, which it has not turned out to be. Number one. Number two, even if it were a controlled substance like pregabalin, your doctor can prescribe it. All you have to do is you go through a different process to do that. So it's never going to be that way. And even if it were, your doctor could do that.
All right, and he told me that he might have to refer me to a neurologist.
Why? Why would he refer
to it? I don't know.
That's absolutely ridiculous. I prescribe gabapentin all the time. I prescribe it for sleep. It's a very good drug for sleep. I prescribe it for neuropathic pain besides the neuropathic pain of shingles for low back pain. It did not meet the FDA criteria at all for that. It's an anti-seizure drug.
Right.
And it does not have to be prescribed by neurologists at all. I mean, we primary care docs probably prescribe most of the gabapentin. So I'm not sure what your doctor is talking about and what they're interested in. It's a very easy drug, not a drug of abuse, well-tolerated. It's not addictive. It's not habit-forming. It's a wonderful drug that has widespread use. I use it all the time. Stick to it. Switch doctors.
Sounds good. I appreciate your advice. I really do.
You're welcome.
And tell Tom to eat his vegetables.
or not.
No, eat. Thank you again.
Yeah, thank you. Before we head out today, Zorba, let's open up the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and share a listener question. The following email came to us from Michael, who writes, Dr. Zorba, I'm a clinician, and I run an urgent care practice in Florida. And I see between 30 and 70 patients per day, depending on the season. 60% of the practice is made up of pediatric patients. When I do not give antibiotics to children because the child has a virus, the parents seem to get upset and voice their concerns online about me and my job, even though the child doesn't need the medications. It really hurts my feelings, so I'm faced with this dilemma. Do I just give children medicines that they don't need, or do I continue to get poorly reviewed online that can eventually shut down my business? What would you do, Zorba?
Well, I would stick to my guns, and I wouldn't give antibiotics when they're not needed. And that's, you know, this is a problematic issue, you know, because people come in, they have an upper respiratory infection, which are viral, you know, the vast 95% of the time, and they want an antibiotic. What I've done with adults that come in with this is I'll often, if they have nasal symptoms, I'll give them a steroid nasal inhaler, and I'll say this will help your symptoms. It'll get things better. With children, it becomes a completely different thing. You want to be ethical. And being ethical is if you don't need the antibiotic, you don't give the antibiotic. And if you're getting negative reviews on Facebook, there are times that you can actually answer those reviews. And the answer should be you do not give unnecessary antibiotics because it leads to antibiotic resistance and it's bad for the child. And that's what you got to do. And that is a very common thing with urgent care practices where people go in, they don't get a prescription, they go, why did I spend the money? I don't have a prescription. In primary care, where you know the patients, like in my practice, they're much more willing to accept that because they know me and trust me. And in urgent care, they don't know the doctor and they don't trust them as much.
Mm-hmm.
Stick to your guns, keep doing the good work. Do not overuse antibiotics.
Have a difficult health question for Zorba? Or maybe you want to post a review for our show? You can do that on our Facebook page, and you can always send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org, or don't forget, we're on Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Did you miss something on today's show? Simply go to ZorbaPastor.org to catch up on all things Zorba. There you will find recipes from the show, links to the Facebook page, Zorba's Healthy Living articles, and you can subscribe to the weekly podcast. On the web, that's zorbapastor.org.